Things are not often as they seem. If you have little children, you know this. You think when you have little kids and there's a noisy silence that everything is wonderful in your house, but you will quickly come to discover as a parent that noisy silence is usually a problem. Maybe your son has taken some rocks from outside or a pencil and put it down the toilet and tried to flush it. That might or might not have happened in our home. I owe him 10 bucks every time I talk about him. So this is where we're at. Or with your daughter, when there's a noisy silence, it might mean they're cutting their bangs, they're cutting their drapes, or they are found their mom's makeup and have painted their face. Sorry, Claire, you got three of them. I don't know if I owe you 30 bucks for that or what. Things aren't always as they seem, sometimes in a good way as well. When you have a particular birthday and you think you're just going to spend a quiet evening at home and your wife has prepared a big birthday party with all your friends, things aren't always as they seem. You might look at the world, though, and you say, man, the world is an evil place. I experience that in my own life, in my work. It's a dog-eat-dog world at work. And character is not valued. Evil is elevated. I can look broadly in the world. I can look in my own life. I can look in my own circumstances. And it seems like evil is winning. And yet God is still at work. God is still at work changing hearts. God is still at work calling people to himself. It's interesting. I don't know about your life, but in my life, some of the most distinctive and important work that God has done in my life and maybe yours is usually behind the scenes. Things in your life, hard things that you struggle with, maybe understanding why God is allowing one thing or not doing another thing, that he's not working on your timetable that you want, the prayers that go unanswered. This morning we come to Esther chapter 6. And we see there more than anything else that things aren't always as they seem. When you look at the first five chapters of Esther, and just at face value, you've seen a plot against God's people, a plot to kill them all in exile. You've seen Haman come up with this plot, and he's batting 1,000 with King Xerxes. He gets anything that he wants with King Xerxes. And now, 5 years into the 11-year or 11-month wait, what you see is that Haman can't take it any longer. He can't take it any longer with his nemesis, Mordecai, the Jew, who won't bow to him. And he comes up with a plot with his family and his friends to take out Mordecai even before all the Jews are going to die. And they've plotted this plan, and he's having breakfast early in the morning with the king. And so everything looks bleak. The gallows have already been made. All that awaits is Haman asking King Xerxes if he can kill Mordecai. That's where we pick it up in chapter 6. But I want you to know something, that God is a God of reversals. Take a look at your own life. Right? When I take a look at my life was heading one way and God called me out and he changed who I was and he brought me to himself. He's a God of reversals. So when things seem bleak in your life, C3, it's easy to give up, isn't it? It's easy to blame God. It's easy to say that God is unjust. Why doesn't he show up in my hardest moments? Maybe he is. Maybe he's just asking you to wait to see what he's up to. Esther chapter 6, turn there with me. Let me read the first four verses, and let me ask you to do this as we read through this text this morning. I want you to notice how many incidental coincidences there are in this text that change the outcome of the story. I want you to consider Vegas's odds on all these things happening and changing the outcome. They would be pretty bleak. Chapter 6, 1 through 4. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king, and it was found written how Mordecai had told Victha and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes. And the king said, "What honor and distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for them. Interesting. A sleepless night for King Xerxes. I don't know if King Xerxes, people have speculated that he had insomnia. People have speculated because they had had the first feast and Esther had said, "Hey, come to my next feast and then I will give you my request." And he's kind of leaving him. Maybe he's wondering about what Esther is going to ask. Maybe the gallows the evening before that Haman is having built are loud outside the window and he can't sleep. I don't know. But one thing is certain and clear. There's no coincidence here. God took sleep from King Xerxes for a reason we're going to find out. I don't know about you, but I sleep really hard. When our kids were little, my wife found out that I was no use if something happened at night. There was one night across the street, no lie, maybe 100 feet away, there was a fire truck going off in the middle of the night because my neighbor right across the street had an electrical fire in their attic. And this thing was loud, apparently. And I didn't wake up until I heard a man's voice in our house. And I felt sorry for my poor wife because I was no help. I sleep that hard and I usually sleep through the night. I go to bed and I wake up in the morning and that's that. I usually sleep really hard, but there are some nights every once in a while where I wake up and I can't go back to sleep no matter what I try to read, no matter what I try to do. And I've gotten to the place where I just assume that God's up to something. I don't know about you, and this, I'm not taking Bible here. I'm just saying in my own life, usually God is trying to communicate something to me when I open my Bible, when I pray in those moments, in those silent moments in the middle of the night when nobody is awake. There's usually something God has for me. I've just gotten to that place where I'm like, okay, what is it, Lord? You come here. Maybe you've had those nights as well. But he wakes up, he can't go to sleep. And so what does he do? He basically, this record book, it's basically a history book. That's what I would do if I'm trying to go back to sleep, wouldn't you? Go get the history book of Persia and read it. And maybe I can go back to sleep. So he has some young attendants come and read the history of Persia. And just by chance, they're looking back 5 years ago. It's 5 years ago when Mordecai, if you remember in chapter 2, at the end of chapter 2, there were two guys that were trying to assassinate King Xerxes that were in the inner, kind of the inner leadership of Persia. And Mordecai heard them talking about their plot to kill him. And he tells Esther, and Esther tells the king at the end of chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 3. And if you know the background of Persia a little bit, they like to celebrate. They like to have feasts. They like to especially celebrate when somebody foils a plot to kill the king. They would honor them with parties and feasts and celebrate that person. But the weirdest thing happens in chapter 2. If you're Mordecai, maybe you're thinking, I'm going to get some recognition out of this. I'm going to get rewarded out of this. I don't know. But all the text says in chapter 2 is it was recorded in the memorial deeds. And then it just goes on like nothing happened. And the next thing you know, King Xerxes is promoting someone and you think it's going to be Mordecai, but it's who? It's Haman, the Agite who hates the Jew. It would be like somebody at your work getting the promotion that you deserve, you thought you deserved, and that person has it out for you for like 5 years. That's the guy that gets promoted. Imagine being Mordecai in that situation. But notice here, 5 years later, 5 years, look at what you have. You have finally, in a in A Sleepless Night for a King. It just so happens that it's a sleepless night right before the morning that Haman's coming, who's batting 1,000 with King Xerxes and saying, let me have Mordecai's head. And so what, now you see the king in this passage. He is wide awake. Why? He asked the question just coincidentally, what did we do to honor him? And the young attendants somehow knew we didn't do anything to honor him. So guess what he's thinking? How are we going to honor him? And he's probably looking around going, who can I talk to about what we can do for this guy who saved my life? And then it says, Haman's, who's in the outer court? Here's the thing. I don't think it would have mattered if it was Haman or someone else. He's probably, the king is probably going, what do you think? What do you think we should do for Mordecai, who has saved me 5 years ago? We forgot to honor him. Do you think any of this is coincidence? Is it happenstance, or is it the hand of God at work delivering his people? See, God is seldom early, but he is never late. He may not work on our timetable, but he's never late. Hebrews 6:10 says it this way. God is not unjust as to forget, hear this in your life, to forget your work and love you show toward his name. Don't grow weary, Galatians says, in doing good. In due season, you will reap. I don't know about you, but that Hebrew verse in chapter 6, it kind of confused me for a bit of the week. I just kept glaring at it. Why does he lead with, what does he mean? What does the author of Hebrews mean by, I don't think God is unjust to forget your work? Because, and then it dawned on me. You know what I do when I don't think I get from God what I want? Where are you, God? Right? I ask questions. Why did that person get something and I didn't? Indirectly what we're saying is, this is unjust, God. It's unjust what that person got that I didn't get, what didn't happen that I think should happen in this situation. And then it made sense. God is not unjust. Here's the way we could say it. Here's your first thought, your first truth this morning. When nobody seems to notice, God does. And maybe you've got stuff in your life right now where you're going, God doesn't notice. Nobody notices. God does. And listen, it may be 5 years. It may be 10 years. You may never see the fruit of that until glory when you're rewarded. But God sees. He's present. He's there. He's not unjust in your life either. Let me ask you this question. Just think about your life. If you look back at your own life, 5 to 7 years, I want you to think about the things 5 to 7 years ago that you were asking of God. Or maybe things, if you're honest, you were upset at God because he hadn't given or he had given it to someone else. 5 to 7 years ago, you're like, I can't even remember what happened to me yesterday. I tend to do better 5 to 7 years, actually. Now I want you to think about all the things that have happened in the last 5 to 7 years. Are there things in your life that you didn't understand? You didn't see the puzzle pieces, but now you can see some of those puzzle pieces and you can look back and say, man, I was impatient. Man, God had something better, or God had something different. And maybe you'd say, I wish I wouldn't have prayed those things given what's happened now. Or maybe there's things that you see in the last 5 to 7 years where you go, man, looking at what I wanted at work, for example, and now seeing what's happened in the last 5 to 7 years there, and I got moved somewhere else, praise God, God put me somewhere else. You see, we don't always see in the present the puzzle pieces, do we? God just calls us to trust him, to trust that he is just, to trust that he does see. So maybe the question is this, are you going through something right now? Are you going through something right now where you're going, God, I need an answer. I need to understand what's going on, and you're not giving it to me. I don't see it. It seems unjust. It seems unfair that maybe 5 to 7 years from now, you could look back and say, man, God was there. He was working, and I'm going to trust him like I've had to trust him before. You know why they built memorials in the Old Testament? They built memorials to the Lord so they remembered what he had done. Ebenezer stones that they would take in the Old Testament and erect to remember. So when they pass by, God worked in my life and his people's life here and here and here and here. It's one of the reasons we come every Sunday and take communion to remind ourselves who our God is and what he has done for us that is most important. Well, God does see, and he does work. He just works sometimes all the time on his own timetable, and it calls us as his people to have to trust and wait. But what's going to happen with Haman? He's been called to the inner court. Are you familiar with the term poetic justice? You're going to see God's right here. Listen to this. I'll start in verse 5. We've seen Haman come in. We know what he wants. The king gets to speak first. Verse 5. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in. And the king said to him, what should be done? I love this phrase. To the man whom the king delights to honor. And Haman said to himself, this is great. Whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn. It's like he's getting the king's memorabilia signed or something. I get it. And the horse that the king had ridden and whose head a royal crown is set, he wants to be king. He wants to do the king thing. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them, this noble official, dress the man whom the king delights to honor. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. He said it a few times here. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do this to Mordecai the Jew, the guy you hate, the guy you want to kill, who sits at the king's gate. He's at work. Leave out nothing that you mentioned. Sounds like David and Nathan, if you remember that story. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed. Man, there's a lot between verse 10 and 11 that I would love to know about. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Poetic justice from God, humiliation rather than honor for Haman. This is rough. King's looking for some advice. Haman just happens to be the person who walks through the door. And he said, this is what I would want. I want for myself. It's coming to me. I want to be king. I want to dress in the king's clothes. I want the king's crown. I want the king's horse. And not only do I want these things, these emblems that represent kingship, I want to be proclaimed throughout Susa. I want honor. I want acclaim. I want status. I want everyone to know how great I am. Things are not always as they seem, are they? He thought he was going to hear his own name called, but he heard someone else's. He heard his biggest enemy. It's interesting in the text where he says, Mordecai, the Jew. He hates the Jew. It reminds me, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5 and 6. It says, clothe yourself. What do we put on? Royal robes? A crown? No. Robe yourself. clothe yourself, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Isn't that what's happening here? He's given Mordecai grace because of his humility. And he's given Haman what he has earned and deserved. And then verse 6 says, humble yourself before the mighty hand of God. And at the proper time, 5 years, that's rough, 5 years, you will be exalted. Here's your thought. In God's plans, what goes around comes around. See, what's gone around for a long time with Haman after he gets promoted is Haman gets to do what he wants. He even gets to create a genocide of God's people. And he parades around what's happened to Mordecai. He's had to try to foil the plot to save God's people. He's been at the king's gate, working, serving two different people, right? When I was in elementary school, my family, we moved from town in Llano, Texas, and we moved out and lived with my grandfather. We owned a bunch of land west of Llano, between Llano and Brady. And my dad, in the summers, was building my mom a house a couple of miles down the road on a piece of land that was our family's. And we lived with our grandfather while our house was built. And we lived with him, A, because our house was being built, but also because my grandfather was older and he had emphysema. And so my mom was taking care of him. Little house, three boys. It was interesting. I remember the room that I got to stay in, and my two other brothers had to stay in a room together. I got my own room, and there were windows out the back, and it faced the west, and it was set on this little hill on Highway 71, out my room, and beautiful sunsets out there. But also, this is first grade, if I remember right. My mom might correct me. But I think it was in first grade where this little, this male peacock would come out, and you could see him through the window. And I'd never seen a peacock before. Start living on the ranch, you see all kinds of things that you've never seen before. This peacock would come out. And at first, you're like, man, he's got his chest out. He unfolds all of his feathers and he struts around. I thought that was pretty cool. My mom and dad told me about peacocks and different things. But after a while, it got really annoying. Every morning, here comes the peacock, right? Chest out, sprawled out like this. And I just got so annoyed at it. I'm in first grade and I took my BB gun. And yes, we got BB guns in first grade out there. And I started shooting. I mean, this is a daisy little gun, all right? So I started shooting as long distance. I started shooting at this peacock because I was just so tired of his arrogance strutting all around. And I got in trouble for it a little bit. Didn't hurt peacock, okay? But it reminds me of what we see with Haman here. He's just strutting around like a male peacock with his chest out and his feathers out, and he needs to be cut down to size. And this is exactly what God does with him, or begins to do with him here. What goes around does come around. So let me ask you this morning, and I'm kind of getting into your kitchen right now, but let me ask you, as I've evaluated in my own life this week, in what ways or circumstances does God need to pull some of those feathers with you? In what ways has he pulled some of those feathers, those peacock kind of feathers with you, and used that hard to humble you? Do you see God's grace and his mercy in that with you? Are you beginning to learn? Are you continuing to learn to clothe yourself in humility? And I don't know about you, but God has to put things in my life to bring humility to my life. Do you see it as his mercy, ultimately as his mercy and his grace, to bring about a dependence on the Lord? Well, what goes around comes around because God is just. The Bible says that God won't leave the guilty unpunished. And maybe you go, well, I don't see that. I don't see that in my world. The unjust win and we lose. Ultimately, though, this is what God does. In the end, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess, right? And so it may not happen where you can see it. But ultimately, it will happen because God is just. He's also not unjust. He sees you. He knows you're there. But here's the interesting thing. How will Mordecai respond to being made a big deal? See, that drug is not just for Haman. It could be for anyone. How will Mordecai respond to being paraded around, to having the king's robes on, having a crown on? Will it go to his head like it has Haman? And how will Haman respond to being humbled or humiliated? That's what you see in verses 12 through 14. Verse 12, then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. That's all you hear about Mordecai. We'll come back to it. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Notice he doesn't fast and pray to Yahweh. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but you shall surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast. Remember the feast that's supposed to happen? I'm sure Haman has forgotten. With everything that's happened right here, there's another feast that Esther has prepared. It seems so understated in verse 12 if you look at it. Mordecai has just been honored. He's been paraded around. And what does the text say? He just goes back to the gate. What does that mean? It means that he just goes back to being the same official that he was before. He just goes back to work. It doesn't say that he goes, hey, I've gotten a taste of this drug of ambition and notoriety and fame. I want more. I'm not going back to the king's gate. I'm going to find a better job. I'm going to Xerxes so I can have promotion, so I can chase this ladder of worldly success. It's not what it says. He says he just goes back to work. Isn't that great? I love that. There is a contentment, if I could say it that way. There's character here, but there is a contentment there. There's a contentment just to say, the king's honored me. I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing. It's the guy that you want. If you're in the military, that's the guy you want in the ditch next to you, who's faithful, who's a servant, that's not trying to make a name for us. Ladies, if you were getting married and you were choosing bridesmaids, this would be the type of girl that's not going to make your wedding about them. This is a faithful guy. This is the kind of guy you want. This is the kind of friend you want. This is the kind of person that's easy to esteem and honor. And yet, look at the contrast. Look at the contrast with Haman. Because he finds all of his value in the approval of others, especially people in power, he's completely devastated. He's mourning, he's weeping, and then he goes to his really good counselors, wise counselors, right? What have his wise counselors been telling him all the way through this book? Hey, just do what you feel you should do. You want retribution? Go seek it. We'll help you build the gallows for this guy. So they have been encouraging Haman to do all the evil that he's been doing. They've been prodding him along, and here it looks different. They actually get a little bit wise, even prophetic. Isn't that interesting with bad counsel? People push you toward things that you want to do, and then in the end, they take their hands off like it's on you, man. That's functionally what's happening here. But they say something that's really interesting. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. There's a sense in which that's prophetic. And I don't think it's because of his skin and his ethnicity. I think it's because the God of the Jews. Unbelieving people, people who don't believe in Yahweh in this time, what have they seen from Yahweh? They have seen Yahweh protect his people. They have seen Yahweh be faithful to his people in spite of them. Remember, they're in exile. So they're not perfect people. They're not morally perfect people. But God has made promises. These people may not understand Genesis 12. I will promise you land, seed, and blessing, and through all the families of the earth, they will be blessed. May not understand that, but they certainly can observe and see. We shouldn't be messing with God's people, because God is faithful, because God has made promises, and all they have to do, and Haman of all people should understand this. Remember who we said his descendants are, the family line that he comes from? He's an Agite. Remember we said that? The ancient descendants of Abimelech. If you go back to Genesis and Exodus, these are people that would come, try to come into the land and take the land from God's people, and God wipes them out. If anybody knows that, it ought to be Haman. Well, here's what I think you see in a contrast that the author here makes. Ultimately, godly contentment, Mordecai wins. Godly contentment wins over selfish ambition. And I use that word ultimately for a reason. Because you know, and I know, man, the dude at work, he's pursuing his own way. He's climbing up the ladder. She's climbing up the ladder. It looks like they're winning. But ultimately, godly contentment wins. First of all, with God, who ought to be more. Whatever we do, work at it with all of our heart. Working for who? Your boss? No. Working for the Lord, not for men. We're looking for honor from the Lord and not from men. So ultimately, godly contentment wins over selfish ambition. Man, and here's the reality. We all have Haman in us, don't we? Let's be honest. It's not like, well, I'm just a content person and I'm good with anything that happens to me and I never struggle with wanting more. That's just not the reality. In our flesh, even as believers in Christ, we can struggle with what the New Testament calls worldly ambition. There's a godly ambition and then there's worldly ambition. Interestingly, what is it for you? For some, there's this propensity, this taste of attention and power and status and honor. It's like the drug that's driving Haman here. And it may be true in our own lives. And we will run over people and things to get it, whatever it is, whatever is the thing that is driving us. And listen, it doesn't matter if it's work out there or in the church, it happens everywhere. You could be serving at the soup kitchen and somebody gives you, or in the church and somebody gives you a little leadership role. Or you see it in others, and they take the whole nine yards. They're like, I'm running everything, and they blow everything up, right? We need the Lord's help for contentment. Isn't that what Paul says? I have learned the secret of being content. I've learned how to get along with a little and a lot. And then what's the punchline? How does contentment work? I can do all things through, this isn't about punching things and lifting weights. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, who helps me be content. And it was a learned trait that Paul had to learn. If you remember Paul, he had everything. He had status. He had honor. He had money. He had everything, and he lost it, Philippians 3, for the sake of Christ. And he saw Christ as the greatest gain. That's how we have contentment, as opposed to pursuing selfish ambition. It's interesting too, here, I'll just make a note. One of the things, and you go, man, I don't know how I know if I'm selfishly ambitious. Well, ask somebody that really cares about you. They could help you. But beyond that, do you tend to want to take vengeance on other people like Haman does Mordecai? One thing you never see in this book, you never see, even though you would look at it and go, Mordecai, you need to get after Haman. You don't see it. You don't see him trying to take retribution. If you're bent that way to go, hey, I need to take vengeance on someone, there may be a contentment issue. driving you. Vengeance is the Lord's. He will deal with it. Interesting. Well, does personal ambition have a grip, any grip on you? Do you have good friends that can be honest with you, unlike these folks here? And I would also say this as a way of encouragement. And maybe you can do this for one another as well. Maybe for your spouse. Maybe for someone you know in the church, to look at them and go, man, I have seen God at work, and I want to celebrate with you the ways in which God has made you more content. More contented in your life with X, Y, and Z over the last year, 5 years, 10 years. That this drug of selfish ambition is not driving you anymore, at least the way it was before. We need to celebrate that as well with one another. Well, next week we're going to see more poetic justice for Haman. He's taken swiftly here to the second feast, where we're going to see Esther finally give the request. But for today, things aren't always as they seem. And you can't see that anywhere greater than the life of Jesus. I want you to think about that. The Pharisees, the religious leaders of the Jews, wanted to kill him. They plotted to kill him. They went to the Romans. They went to one of Jesus' own, sold him for 30 shekels. And they thought they had won. They delivered him up to the Romans, and the Romans participated. And they scourged him, and they beat him, and they gave him a cross to bear up Calvary's hill. And you got to know that they were saying, we win, as this was happening. You got to believe that the evil one in all of this time is saying, there's going to be victory. We're going to put the Messiah down. We're going to crush him. He goes to the cross and he says to all these people who are putting him there, who are in the process of killing him, I forgive you. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. The debt is paid, and they think they've got him. He dies on a cross, and they think they've won. The evil one certainly believes that he has won, that there is victory. And yet you know that on the third day, Jesus rose again, and he was victorious. He was victorious over death and sin for you and for me. We can talk about our own story. A God of great reversals. There's no greater reversal than what happened at the cross and at the tomb, where God changes the course of history like that. Something that looked for sure in the bag for the evil one, the Jews and the Romans, and he rose again for you and for me. See, God is a God of great reversals. Things are not always as they seem, but your punchline today is this: God is always who he says he is. He always does what he says he will do. He doesn't change. Even when you feel like, and it seems like, he is being unjust, even when you don't understand why he allows or doesn't do things in your life, he's there. He's just. He is always who he says he is. He says he will never leave the guilty unpunished. He will take care. He will bring vengeance. That's his job, not ours. It also means, if he is always who he says he is and he always does what he says he will do, it also means that you and I have the ability as followers of Christ to live in contentment, to live in his strength, live without vengeance, live without trying to make glory happen for ourselves, resting in his glory and his grace. Things aren't always as they seem, but God is always who he says he is. Trust him. Let me pray.
What a great promise, Father, that is.
Would you help us in our weaknesses to trust you for who you are, even when things seem bleak, even when circumstances don't turn our way?
Would you help us remember your promise to us that yet while we are sinners, Christ died for us, that we have the hope of Christ, the hope of forgiveness, the hope of resurrection. And as we live today, would you give us through your Spirit a godly contentment to live our lives to glorify you, that we don't need to seek our own way, that we need to seek your way, that we need to make much of you. Would you guide us and direct us? We thank you. We thank you for your love and your grace, that you've taken a bunch of Hamans and you've changed us as the God of great reversals. In Jesus' name, amen.